Chapter 3. You are being modified against your will, and to what end? When I claim there's a globalist mad scientist conspiracy, people often ask, "Well, where's your proof, Alex?" How about we start with this from a 2016 Marketplace article about Matthew Lau, a bioethicist from New York University. Dr. S. Matthew Lau, a bioethicist at New York University, believes that solving climate change starts with the individual. That's why he suggests we turn humans into cat-eyed, less need for electric light, meat-allergic, we all become vegan, semi-genius hobbit people, less need for resources. His proposal is dead serious, not a kind of Jonathan Swiftian exercise, and it has economic implications. It's centered around the idea that we have passed a point of no return with man-made climate change. There are a lot of ideas on the table when it comes to fighting the environmental impact of humans and technology, as we move further and further into a world where there is vast scientific consensus and a paradoxical public resistance to that idea, the ideas are getting weirder and weirder. One idea floated by scientists is geoengineering, shooting aerosols into the atmosphere and cooling the surface temperature. Another, boosted again this week by a $1 billion investment fund led by Bill Gates, is clean energy innovation. Lau doesn't discount these, but he believes that in some ways, that bioengineering our bodies is going to be part of the overall solution and be less dangerous than trying to change the entire planet's atmosphere with geoengineering. These globalist mad scientists want to turn us into a race of cat-eyed, vegan hobbit people because they think it's less dangerous than chemtrail skies or other global climate strategies, which are likely to go terribly wrong. And what did Professor Lau, a favored intellectual of the World Economic Forum, say about a way to fight climate change by inducing people to have a red meat allergy? It turns out that we can use human engineering to help us address climate change. People eat too much meat, right? And if they were to cut down on their consumption of meat, it would actually help the planet. But people are not willing to give up meat. We can use human engineering to make it the case that we're intolerant to certain kinds of meat. That's something we can do through human engineering. The method by which they could achieve this madness is by inducing something called an alpha-gal allergy, usually acquired by a tick bite. Alpha-gal is a sugar molecule found in most mammals, and I will let you know I'm suspicious of the claim that one can get an alpha-gal allergy from consuming mammal meat. The digestive juices in the stomach and intestines are likely to break down the alpha-gal molecule. That's basic biology. But what is the closest analogy to a tick bite in our modern world? Putting this molecule directly into the bloodstream, where it can cause damage. A vaccine. And isn't it curious that the CDC, on its own website, acknowledges that vaccines and other medicines contain this molecule? This is from the CDC website. Some medications and vaccines may contain small amounts of alpha-gal additives, stabilizers, or coatings. Not all patients with AGS react to these ingredients. Lists of additives to specific vaccines, called vaccine excipients, are available through CDC's Pink Book and the Institute of Vaccine Safety. Ingredients that may contain alpha-gal include, but are not limited to, gelatin, glycerin, magnesium stearate, bovine extract. I understand there are a significant number of my viewers who may not understand why I am such a passionate critic of our current vaccines. It is because I have had countless conversations with leading scientists and other experts that have led me to conclude that all current vaccines are dangerous, and one should also avoid most pharmaceutical drugs. Vaccines and most pharmaceutical drugs are being used by the globalists to soften up our defenses and eventually eliminate a fair portion of humanity. You may think that's just too much, that people couldn't be that evil. But consider bioethicist Matthew Lau, beloved figure of the globalists. He wants to turn you into a cat-eyed, hobbit-sized vegetarian. And because he's doing it in the service of fighting climate change, he'll feel good about it. That is the pathology against which we are fighting. Life is flexible. I want you to understand why I believe this idea so strongly. The life force is so powerful that we, as biological organisms, can put up with a lot. God has endowed his creatures with magnificent feedback systems to address the challenges they might face. Science has long held that humans come into this world as a tabula rasa, a blank slate, upon which the experiences of a lifetime make their mark. What can the experiences of our lives, whether it be fear, bravery, or cowardice, make a mark upon our offspring? For decades, the idea of so-called genetic memories would have been heretical, and yet science today is showing that the experiences of one generation can be passed down to the next generation, as shown by a study of mice from 2013, which showed that certain fears can be passed down through the generation. An article in Nature explained the genesis of this research. Kerry Ressler, a neurobiologist and psychiatrist at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and a co-author of the latest study, became interested in epigenetic inheritance after working with poor people in inner cities, where cycles of drug addiction, neuropsychiatric illness, and other problems often seem to recur in parents and their children. There's a lot of anecdotes to suggest that there's intergenerational transfer of risk, and that it's hard to break that cycle, he says. Studying the biological basis for those effects in humans would be difficult. So Ressler and his colleague, Brian Diaz, opted to study epigenetic inheritance in laboratory mice trained to fear the smell of acetophenone, a chemical the scent of which has been compared to those of cherries and almonds. He and Diaz wafted the scent around a small chamber while giving small electric shocks to male mice. The animals eventually learned to associate the scent with pain, shuddering in the presence of acetophenone even without a shock. Although I'm not a speciesist, it's difficult not to have a little sympathy for these male mice subjected to small electric shocks. Yeah, the shocks were probably small to the researchers, but something different to the mice. But the parallel to humans is clear. If one stimulus, such as a smell, is associated with pain, an organism will be terrified by the stimulus, regardless of whether that painful insult is ever delivered. This is much like Pavlov's dogs, salivating when they hear a bell, which they associate with being fed. We understand that idea, but what blew the researchers' minds was the understanding that such fears might get passed down through some mechanism in our genes. This reaction was passed on to their pups, Diaz and Ressler report today in Nature Neuroscience. Despite never having encountered acetophenone in their lives, the offspring exhibited increased sensitivity when introduced to its smell, shuddering more markedly in its presence compared with the descendants of mice that had been conditioned to be startled by a different smell or that had gone through no such conditioning. A third generation of mice the grandchildren, also inherited the reaction, as did mice conceived through in vitro fertilization with sperm from males sensitized to acetophenone. Similar experiments showed that the response can also be transmitted down from the mother. This is biological proof that the experiences of a lifetime can be passed down through the generations. The fears of the father or mother can be passed down to their offspring. While this is a robust demonstration of the idea that fear can be passed down to the children, does this same principle hold for things like courage, wisdom, and compassion? I don't have enough evidence for a definitive answer, but if you look at things like generations of families who serve in the military, one might conclude it's likely that bravery, once expressed, will lead to offspring for whom such courage comes more easily than the rest of the general population. How might such a trait work on a genetic level? The researchers had some clues and a possible explanation. The researchers proposed that DNA methylation, a reversible chemical modification to DNA that typically blocks transcription of a gene without altering its sequence, explains the inherited effect. In the fearful mice, the acetophenome-sensing gene of sperm cells had fewer methylation marks, which could have led to greater expression of the odorant receptor gene during development. But how the association of smell with pain influences sperm remains a mystery. Ressler notes that sperm cells express odorant receptor proteins, and that some odorants find their way into the bloodstream, offering a potential mechanism, as do small, blood-borne fragments of RNA, known as microRNAs, that control gene expression. Isn't God's design for the success of his creations truly remarkable? If one slavishly followed Darwin's idea of natural selection, this result would be unbelievable. Darwin believed nature works only on a generational timescale, not within the lifespan of a single organism. If we accept the proposition that being made to fear something during one's lifespan has the ability to turn a gene on or off through the activity of microRNAs, it follows that all of our actions would have similar consequences for who we are. Could it be that, in humans, our experiences and responses during our life are controlling the expression of our genes? It would be unethical to perform these experiments on humans. But we do have such groups available for study: Holocaust survivors and their children. This research from 2016 is genuinely enlightening. Animal studies have demonstrated that epigenetic changes from stress exposure can be passed on to the offspring. In the new study, Yehuda and colleagues examined these relationships for the first time in humans with methylation of FKBP5, a stress-related gene that has been associated with PTSD and depression. The researchers examined blood samples of 32 Holocaust survivors and 22 of their adult children, and Jewish parent-offspring control pairs for methylation of intron 7, a specific region within the FKBP5 gene. The analysis revealed that both Holocaust survivors and their offspring show epigenetic changes at the same site of FKBP5 intron 7, but in the opposite direction. Holocaust survivors had 10% higher methylation than control parents, whereas Holocaust offspring had 7.7% lower methylation than control offspring. John Crystal, editor of Biological Psychiatry, noted that the observation that the changes in parent and child are in opposing directions suggests that children of traumatized parents are not simply born with a PTSD like biology. They may inherit traits that promote resilience as well as vulnerability. Do you want to know how mice and men are different? Think of the different outcomes between the two species. In one instance, the offspring inherit the fear from their parents. But in human beings, it's likely that our brain allows us to come to terms with our trauma. For example, we can understand how somebody exposed to the horrors of the Holocaust would be permanently affected by that experience. However, in addition to experiencing the horrors of the Holocaust, those who survived would know the satisfaction of liberation, as well as the subsequent prosecution of many of the top Nazis, the establishment of the State of Israel, and other positive developments for Jews. In other words, they would experience both the horror and the hope. The Holocaust survivors were likely to feel a measure of justice had been delivered to their oppressors, and it would make sense that this information would also be passed on to their children. Just as fear would leave a mark on their genetic code, justice might do something similar in the opposite direction. It might result in a person with a lower-than-average anxiety that good things will happen. It could also trigger a victimology, where the survivors and their offspring begin to see threats everywhere that may not exist. Many a historian has noted that oppressed groups, in many cases, will seek power from a position of fear and will imitate the abuses done to them against completely innocent groups. I am concerned that in 2021, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was among the first world leaders to make a deal with Pfizer for the COVID-19 vaccines and used strong government coercion to get people to take the shot. And of course, where did he deliver these remarks? At the 2021 Davos World Economic Forum, where he said he hoped to make Israel a world laboratory for herd immunity. Doesn't human experimentation on such a vast scale sound like something we'd like to avoid? Here are Netanyahu's own words from a December 2022 interview with Jordan Peterson on what he did. "We came out of COVID first. I described that in my book, my conversations with Albert Bourla, president of Pfizer, and I persuaded him to give tiny Israel the necessary vaccines to get out first from the COVID. And the reason I could do that is we have a database. 98% of our population has digitized medical records and a little card. And anywhere you go, in any hospital in Israel, north or south, it doesn't make any difference. Boom. You punch it in, and you know everything about this patient for the last 20 years. I said, we'll use that to tell you whether these vaccines, what they do to people. Not individual people, not with the individual identities, but statistically. What does it do to people with meningitis? What does it do to people with high blood pressure? You want to know that. Israel became, if you will, the laboratory for Pfizer. And that's how we did it. We gave the information to the world, not only published in medical magazines. That's the database we have. I intend to bring onto that database of personal medical records for entire populations, a genetic database, genomes, okay? Give me a saliva sample, voluntarily, but I'm sure most people would do it. Maybe we'll pay them. Now we have genetic records of a robust population. You have to have a diverse population. We have people from 100 lands. This is a very powerful engine. Now let pharma companies, let medical companies, let them run algorithms on this database, okay? I'll tell you, they'll give preference for a few years to Israeli firms and then to the world. But you can create a biotechnological industry that is unheard of, unimagined even. And these are just examples. We can stave off Iran, become a light unto the nations, groundbreaking. It's stunning to understand how deluded Netanyahu is about turning his country over to the tender mercies of Pfizer. I can't see into his heart, but it seems like he just invited the wolves into the henhouse. Who knows to what terrors his decision will lead? It seems like Netanyahu is a leading cheerleader for a digital totalitarian future, in which the state knows everything about you. There's an anecdote that's often told in motivational business meetings about fleas. Part of the claim, which I can easily substantiate, is that fleas are the world's greatest jumpers, and that if a man possessed the jumping ability of a flea, he could easily jump over the Eiffel Tower in Paris with an acceleration rate 50 times greater than a rocket taking off into space. The claim that is often made in these motivational meetings is that fleas kept inside a jar with a lid will spend a couple days hitting the lid and then stop jumping that high. As the story then goes, their offspring will also not jump higher than the lid, even if there is no lid present. I can't find any good information to corroborate the second part of this claim, but it feels accurate to me. Whether the particulars of the flea story are accurate or not, it seems to me the main idea, specifically that we adapt to our environment, and that these adaptations may encode themselves in our genes, is likely to be true. It is for this reason that the thought we allow ourselves, as well as the limitations we place upon ourselves and our children, are likely to be of paramount importance. We must also ask ourselves if there is perhaps some psychological and content knowledge with which we are born, an instinctive body of knowledge we possess because of the experiences our ancestors have had. This possibility is suggested by research on so-called idiot savants who seem to know things they have never been taught. An opinion piece in Science from 2015 explored this possibility. Steven Pinker's 2003 book, The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, refutes the blank slate theories of human development. Brian Butterworth, in his 1999 book, What Counts? How Every Brain is Hardwired for Math, points out that babies have many specialized innate abilities, including numerical ones, that he attributes to a number module encoded in the human genome from ancestors 30,000 years ago. Whether called genetic, ancestral, or racial memory, or congenital gifts, the concept of a genetic transmission of sophisticated knowledge well beyond instincts is necessary to explain how prodigious savants can know things they never learned. Let's consider the plans set up by people like Yuval Noah Harari and his fellow Confederates at the World Economic Forum. Might there be something fixed about human nature, such as male and female, or how much we wouldn't like to become a cyborg? Could concepts like respect for each other, the need to honor our parents, and the demonstrated superiority of the two-parent family be something that is genetically encoded in us? Before you reject this idea out of hand, I encourage you to consider the following passage. Finally, the animal kingdom provides examples of complex inherited capacities beyond physical characteristics. Monarch butterflies each year make a 2,500-mile journey from Canada to a small plot of land in Mexico where they winter. In spring, they begin the long journey back north, but it takes three generations to do so. So, no butterfly making the return journey has flown that entire route before. How do they know a route they never learned? It has to be an inherited GPS-like software, not a learned route. Ossian birds such as sparrows, thrushes, and warblers learn their songs from listening to others. Sub-ossian species such as flycatchers and their relatives, in contrast, inherit all the genetic instructions they need for these complex arias. Even if raised in soundproof isolation, the sub-ossian birds can give the usual call for their species with no formal training or learning. There are so many more examples from the animal kingdom in which very complex traits, behaviors, and skills are inherited and innate. We call those instincts in animals, but we haven't applied this concept to the complex inherited skills and knowledge in humans. While one might think the limited instance of savants may be limited to those with some type of inherited brain abnormality, the article goes on to state that there are numerous examples of otherwise normal humans who suffer some sort of brain injury, who immediately develop these savant characteristics in math, music, or some other domain. This supports my idea that there is something fixed or preordained in the human mind, call it culture or our hardwiring, about how we are supposed to organize ourselves in society, that will defy attempts by anybody to alter it. Could this be the fatal flaw of the globalists? They think they can change human behavior, and to some extent I believe they can, but there may be certain immutable characteristics of the human constitution that will forever frustrate them. Their plans can work, but only for a time. Then those plans fall disastrously apart. Consider the innate fear response of ducks to the shape of a hawk flying above them, from this famous experiment in 1959. Mallard clucks were reared in a highly restricted environment from hatching until testing began at 25 days of age. The stimuli presented were moving cardboard models resembling a hawk or goose in flight. Those ducks who had earlier experience with flying models showed no fear when the same models were presented in a series of tests. Ducks that had no early experience with the models showed marked fear of the models initially, regardless of shape. There was significantly more fear of the hawk than the goose model in the second series of presentations. But habituation to both models occurred quickly, and fear responses to the cardboard models flying were not elicited after the third day of testing. The results indicate that both inherited and environmental factors collaborate in the genesis of the fear of visual patterns presented by predatory birds. There are so many intriguing parts to this research. Again, we have this transmission of knowledge across generations, and yet life must also be designed for changed conditions. It makes sense that ducks would come preloaded with information telling them to fear hawks, but nature works on models of efficiency. If hawks stop being a problem, the organism should be able to process that new information and make a different choice. One would assume the ability to learn and have that be reflected somehow in your genes would also work if some new threat came upon the scene. In other words, living organisms undergo genetic changes, maybe just in their microRNA, or some other part we don't fully understand, due to the environment in which they find themselves. One could imagine this means that humans enter this world with some general understandings of how to interact with other human beings, perhaps some hardwired math and language skills, and a likely drive to pair with a member of the opposite sex for the purpose of creating an intimate bond, which will include the raising of children. But we would also need to be flexible. Let's say there's a famine, natural disaster, or a time of protracted warfare. During those times, will humans look to creating those bonds with the same intensity, or will those desires be subsumed so that the problem will consume most of their attention? It sounds like a wonderfully designed system, providing, one, some roadmap of what would be helpful in life, and yet also allowing some flexibility in the system. However, there are limits. Will animals continue to live in ways that will bring about collapse of the species? And if so, what might some of those ways look like? It seems the attempt to create a utopia without struggle is one of the easiest ways to bring about societal collapse. In a famous series of experiments in 1968, biologist John Calhoun built a colony, a large pen, with what he believed would be the perfect environment for a colony of rats, with no predators and abundant food. It turns out, struggle is necessary for the survival of a species, as well as for individual happiness. These utopias kept collapsing. This is part of what he wrote about the collapse of the 25th mouse utopia. Rodents have social hierarchies, with dominant alpha males controlling harems of females. Alphas establish dominance by fighting, wrestling, and biting any challengers. Normally, a mouse that loses a fight will scurry off to some distant nook to start over elsewhere. But in Mouse Utopia, the losing mice couldn't escape. Calhoun called them dropouts. And because so few juveniles died, huge hordes of dropouts would gather in the center of the pen. They were full of cuts and ugly scars, and every so often, huge brawls would break out. Vicious free-for-alls of biting and clawing that served no obvious purpose. In other words, Mouse Antifa. It was just senseless violence. In earlier utopias involving rats, some dropouts turned to cannibalism. The intent of these mouse utopias was to see if they might serve as models for urban planning, as both rodents and humans share many behavioral characteristics. Instead, it seemed to simply prove as dangerous as most progressive ideas for the improvement of society. Think of the frontier, or how in traditional conservative ideology, there are wild places where one may be alone with one's own thoughts. The existence of such places is necessary for our mental health. Young males who have not achieved what they want should not be forced together with other similarly low-status males. That is a recipe for disaster. Ideally, those young males who don't succeed at first need to be alone to figure out how to eventually prevail with what they want to accomplish in life, and then re-engage in the fight. And is there a better demonstration of bad social planning than young groups of males simply fighting with each other for no reason? As Canadian intellectual Jordan Peterson likes to say, young males need a purpose in life. A society filled with young men who have no purpose is a dangerous society. That's why what we have done in society has made all our lives so much more dangerous. We have created the expression toxic masculinity, and no model for what is healthy masculinity. And why is there no societal discussion of toxic femininity? If we have the idea for one gender, shouldn't we have it for the other? Male and female strengths should be celebrated, and not just when some man decides to become a woman, so he can dominate a particular sport and be named Woman of the Year. Let's dig a little more deeply into the societal collapse of this mouse utopia. Alpha males struggled too. They kept their harems in private apartments, which they had to defend from challengers. But given how many mice survived to adulthood, there were always a dozen hotshots ready to fight. The office soon grew exhausted, and some stopped defending their apartments altogether. As a result, apartments with nursing females were regularly invaded by rogue males. The mothers fought back, but often to the detriment of their young. Many stressed-out mothers booted their pups from the nest early, before the pups were ready. A few even attacked their own young, or abandoned them, while fleeing to different apartments, leaving the pups to die of neglect. To listen to progressives, one would think that all you need to do is disrupt things at the top, and we'll all be so much better. But look at how you disturb the system, and you create a cascade of unintended consequences. The alphas are exhausted from fighting too much, and the females get bothered so consistently by rival males that they do a bad job of raising their offspring, and everything begins to fall apart. It doesn't make sense to participate in such a poorly functioning society, and many mice make the decision to opt out. Eventually, other deviant behavior emerged. Mice who had been raised improperly or kicked out of the nest early failed to develop healthy social bonds and therefore struggled in adulthood with social interactions. Maladjusted females began isolating themselves like hermits in empty apartments, unusual behavior among mice. Maladjusted males, meanwhile, took to grooming all day, preening and licking themselves hour after hour. Calhoun called them the beautiful ones. And yet, even while obsessing over their appearance, these males had zero interest in courting females, zero interest in sex. Does that sound like human society in 2023, rather than a rat colony in 1968? Yeah, I'm having some trouble understanding the differences as well. Kids who don't know how to interact or play like children, thanks social media, women who aren't interested in sex, and yet are strangely so passionate about abortion, and men who aren't doing their jobs as husbands or fathers. I've heard it said by people like cartoonist Scott Adams, another de facto tribe member of the Banished, that marriage just isn't a good deal for men these days. What do they get out of it? Somebody who values them? Somebody who will stick with them to the end? A long-term relationship with a member of the opposite sex is the ultimate experience of diversity, because men and women are so different, and yet complementary to each other. If you haven't had the pleasure, or the pain sometimes, it's the greatest ride of your life. Not for the faint of heart. In marriage, there are no safe spaces, believe me. Women may have gotten the idea from progressives that the attack on the patriarchy would be some sort of panacea of unlimited riches, but it didn't work out very well in the mouse utopia, and it's unlikely to be any different for humans. Between the lack of sex, which lowered the birth rate, and inability to raise pups properly, which sharply increased infant mortality, the population of Universe 25 began to plummet. By the 21st month, newborn pups rarely survived more than a few days. Soon, new births stopped altogether. Older mice lingered for a while, hiding like hermits or grooming all day, but eventually they died out as well. By spring 1973, less than 5 years after the experiment started, the population had crashed from 2,200 to zero. Mouse heaven had gone extinct. Does that sound like the bleakest future possible? Complete extinction. And while I know there will always be pockets of strong individuals, like my native Texas, although I'm growing worried about Austin, one need only look at the urban cities of America to see a similar sort of social collapse And how did John Calhoun view the results of his work? Calhoun's big takeaway involved status. Again, the males who lost the fights for dominance couldn't leave to start over elsewhere. As he saw it, they were stuck in pathetic, humiliating roles and lacked a meaningful place in society. The same went for females when they couldn't nurse or raise pups properly. Both groups became depressed and angry and began lashing out. In other words, because mice are social animals, they need meaningful social roles to feel fulfilled. Humans are social animals as well, and without a meaningful role, we too can become hostile and lash out. What would happen to John Calhoun today if he published his work? Would he be accused of supporting the patriarchy, rather than simply being interested in learning the truth? Or would they criticize the diversity of his mouse population? Were there sufficient numbers of black mice in the sample? Because, perhaps among mice, there might also be white supremacist ideals. However, I don't view this research as being about the role of males in a society, but how we have healthy populations. The males get to fight for dominance, but after that has been established, a certain order prevails. Those who lose the fight for dominance are free to leave and seek out new domains. Males who can't yet establish a place for themselves can strike out for new territories where they might be successful. The females have the luxury of knowing who the superior males are, with whom to mate, to give their offspring the best chance of survival. And with the hierarchies established, the females are free to give their offspring the attention they need to continue the species. They don't get bothered by the male riffraff. Everybody wins. But doesn't it seem in our modern world that everybody is losing? Males or females at the top of our modern hierarchy have less security and more stress. Caring for children has become so much more problematic, and disillusioned young men without a purpose retreat into porn, video games, practices like transgenderism or polyamory, and sometimes shooting up those places, like their former schools, which they believe lie at the root of their problems. Isn't it time we talked about these problems and maybe did something about them? Let's look at one of the greatest recent failures of the globalists, the spectacular implosion of Mark Zuckerberg's plan to create an immersive digital world in which the useless eaters envisioned by Yuval Noah Harari will want to spend their lives while also being kept docile with drugs. An article from CNBC detailed this multi-billion dollar folly. Mark Zuckerberg's dream of a future in the metaverse is costing investors a boatload of money. In its earnings report after the bell on Wednesday, Meta said its Reality Labs division, home to the company's virtual reality technologies and projects, posted a $4.28 billion operating loss in the fourth quarter, bringing its total for 2022 to $13.72 billion. It was a tough first full year for the new Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook. In late 2021, Zuckerberg changed the company's name and said its future would be in the metaverse, a digital universe where people will work, shop, play, and learn. Just think of what good might have been done with more than $13.72 billion. Hell, that could have paid off all my legal bills and fines and still left Zuckerberg with a little more than $12 billion. And if you found the loss of more than $13 billion to be an inconceivable defeat, that was just the start of the problems, as reported by the New York Times in February 2023. You see, when the globalists start losing, it just keeps getting worse. Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook, suffered its biggest one-day wipeout ever on Tuesday, as its stock plummeted 26% and its market value plunged by more than $230 billion. Its crash followed a dismal earnings report on Wednesday, when Mark Zuckerberg, the chief executive, laid out how the company was navigating a tricky transition from social networking toward the so-called virtual world of the metaverse. On Thursday, a company spokesman reiterated statements from its earnings announcement and declined to comment further. Call me immature, but if I'd been in that press conference, I'd keep asking, "Can you repeat that number again? I thought you said more than $230 billion. When they provided the number, I'd reply, "I'm not sure my hearing is very good. It sounded like you said you'd lost more than $230 billion. After their confirmation, I'd ask, "Did you just say in a single day you lost more than $230 billion in value? Is that correct?" I think you get the idea. I'd play that joke as long as I could, maybe 2 or 3 hours. When you find yourself worried about the enemy we face, I want you to remember the alien android. Mark Zuckerberg is one of their champions, the guy who destroyed more than $230 billion in value for his company in a single day. It's almost as if God has placed them in their positions to make these stupid decisions. Humanity has a very bright future if these are our enemies. The world these idiots want to build, plugging you into video games while they give you drugs, isn't even a winning short-term strategy. It's said that intellectuals know everything except what's important, such as what's good for human beings. What's the effect on a typical person living in Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse for just a week? Shouldn't Zuckerberg have known that before he chose to spend billions of dollars on the effort? Scientists in England and Germany looked into that question. The study, conducted by researchers from a number of European institutions, including Coburg University in Germany and Cambridge University in the UK, compared the experiences of 16 university staff or researcher participants who spent a 35-hour work week in normal physical office spaces and another week doing the same work in virtual reality. The researchers wrote that working in VR for a week resulted in significantly worse ratings across most measures for participants, particularly in terms of health effects and productivity. Employees' anxiety over their job increased by 19% when working in the metaverse, while their perception of their workload grew by 35% relative to the week spent in a physical office, despite researchers ensuring that workloads in the virtual and physical work weeks were similar. Additionally, workers reported their frustration with being unable to complete work in a timely or efficient manner increased by 42% while in VR, while self-reported productivity fell by 16%. Way to go, Zuckerberg! In a week, you made these employees 42% more frustrated that they weren't accomplishing their work, and their self-reported productivity fell by 16%. This might be the worst idea in all of business history. I'm sure Zuckerberg's investors are happy they followed him off that cliff. And if the initial effects of the virtual world appear to be so harmful, what about the effects of social media on children, led by the very same Mark Zuckerberg, but added to by such applications as Snapchat, Instagram, and the Chinese app TikTok? Here's one of the first studies of its kind, from 2019, which was published in the Journal of American Pediatrics. The title of the article is Association of Screen Time and Depression in Adolescence. And in the discussion section, the authors wrote, "To our knowledge, this study is the first to use developmental data from a large sample of adolescents to examine the association between four types of screen time and depression. We found that high mean levels of social media over 4 years and any further increases in social media use in the same year were associated with increased depression. We also demonstrated that the tendency to engage in high mean levels of television over 4 years was associated with less depression. However, any further increase in television use in the same year was associated with increased depression." In plain English, what this means is that any use of social media leads to increased depression among adolescents. For television, the picture is mixed. It appears some television watching, even an initial high level, is associated with less depression. This might be explained by the fact that television has the potential to allow us into the lives of other individuals, or, based upon our viewing habits, explore our interests to our heart's content, like binge-watching all seasons of Ancient Aliens or The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. But increasing television usage, meaning you've likely got nothing else to do in your day, leads to increased depression. The discussion continued. Furthermore, we showed that high mean levels of computer use over 4 years are associated with increased depression. However, any further increase in computer use in the same year is not associated with increased depression. Furthermore, video gaming is not associated with depression. Finally, post hoc analyses reveal that self-esteem, but not exercise, is associated with depression and adolescence, and that only social media and television have a time-varying negative association with self-esteem within person association. A picture emerges of how the human adolescent could best manage our new digital media landscape. First, stay off social media. Any usage appears to be harmful to young people and probably adults. Second, moderating television watching is probably good for you. If you watch too much television, that probably suggests there are other problems, like maybe not having a job. Third, high computer usage seems to bring about depression, but it levels off. Maybe we need to keep the adolescents off the computers as much as possible and into after-school activities with others. And in what might be the most surprising result, video games do not appear to be correlated with increased depression. I have some of my own thoughts on this finding. Consider the typical video game that teenage boys typically play. They're a liberal nightmare. They aren't about kindness and cooperation. They're about driving a car as fast as possible, surviving a zombie apocalypse, or killing terrorists. Have I pretty much covered the waterfront? For better or worse, finding the limits of machines or protecting others is a male virtue. That's the story countless teenage boys have been told in these games. Their skill and bravery are what will make the difference to the future. The only problem with these games is that when the teenage boys step out into the real world, they're told that these virtues are not wanted. The solution isn't to tell young boys that those games are bad. We should look upon them just as we do initiation rites in primitive tribes, then tell them that the virtues of these games are needed when they become men. Those virtues will be needed for humanity to be safe, for their wives and daughters to be protected, and for the next generation to have a safe space, so they can grow to maturity and take their place in society. What might some of the positive things be that you can do on a regular basis to fully express your humanity? You can laugh and joke with your fellow citizens. Take some time to pray every day. Reflect on those who have done good things for you in the past, and thank them either in person, over a call, maybe in a text, or if they're no longer around, send up a thought or prayer and trust that it will somehow find them. In other words, how do you respond to a corrupt world? Try to be the best person you can be. Be joyful, knowing God created the universe and everything in it, and the globalists can only hope to be parasites in this beautiful world. And let's investigate building positive human communities, where free speech is not only permitted, but celebrated, and we share the common values of family, honesty, and integrity. The globalists are terrified of humans joining together, men and women, people of all colors and creeds, because those things that connect us are so much stronger than any of our differences. Here's a suggestion from the Wall Street Journal. Go for a walk in nature with a friend. A brisk walk in nature with a friend combines three of the most effective stress-reducing and resilience-building techniques, according to psychologists and scientific research: physical exercise, social connection, and spending time in nature. The activity works by helping normalize the hormonal changes that result from chronic stress and boosting the emotional resources that help us cope. Even if it's just 20 minutes around your neighborhood, the walk is good for you physically, immunologically, especially when you do it with someone else, says Helen L. Coons, associate professor and clinical health psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. There's my advice to you at the end of this chapter. Go for a walk with a friend and have a satisfying conversation. I want you to be strong for the battles ahead. If you can't go for a walk with a friend, take some time for yourself now and do something you enjoy. I'll be waiting here for you when you get back. But don't take too long. We have a world to save.